Welcome, my name is Tony, and I am the creator of the Tone Guy's Terrifically Tall Tales podcast. In the future, you'll hear my own content here, but in the meantime, I'm going to give you a few teaser episodes of Reese Lovell's upcoming audiobook, Catharsis, which is going to release on Audible on September 1st, 2024. I hope you enjoy it.
Catharsis, written and performed by Reese Lovell. Audio production by M. Anthony Reimer. Chapter 3, June 30th, Chicago, Illinois. The entry to Sim C, identical to the other two rooms, was a short, narrow corridor with an automated door on both ends. Clients' vitals were read inside the passageway, both going in and coming out. Additionally, blood pressure and heart rate were closely monitored throughout the duration of the event. Several years prior, a client had suffered a heart attack during his simulation and nearly died inside the room. Another time, in California, a 40-year-old woman had died of an asthma attack. The woman's family sued, and as a result, the business had gone under. Now, not even Valak was exempt from the layers of protocol meant to protect the company as much as the client. He waited in the passageway, humming quietly as he gripped the metal bars that would clear him for admittance. Attached to the walls on either side, they sent his vitals to the control room, establishing the baseline by which they would monitor his reactions. He thought about Meredith Saint. Pictured her stepping out of the shower, hair freshly shampooed, body fragrant with the scent of lavender. He would have been more than happy to take her on vacation had she accepted his offer. Now that he thought about it, though, he really hadn't given her enough time to consider. He'd try again later. Maybe start with dinner, go from there. A soft beep sounded, followed by a voice that said,
"System's normal. You may proceed."
The door in front of him opened to reveal the living room of his home in Lake Forest, Illinois. His initial reaction was one of utter amazement. He was stunned, slack-jawed at what lay before him. This was far more than just a crude replica. It was an exact copy, to the extent that Valak had trouble accepting that this was not, in fact, the real thing. He saw nothing to convince him otherwise, and he trembled a bit as he absorbed the room's meticulous detail. Each room was designed months in advance by a team of architects. Led by Meredith Saint, they honed and crafted each habitat with careful precision. Valak wondered if it gave her any pleasure to see them destroyed. Probably not. He doubted she spent much time at all in the control room observing the fruits of her labor. Yet, one of the reasons clients were willing to pay obscenely for 15 minutes of unbridled rage was because the habitats at Catharsis were so utterly real. They reported that the experience was most immersive and most fulfilling when the copy replicated the original in every detail. And God knew, this particular copy came about as close to the source as any of their designs. Valak took a few tentative steps forward, then abruptly turned to look behind him. The entryway through which he'd just passed was gone. In its place stood the room's west wall. He knew it was a hologram, just as he knew the coffered ceiling above him was nothing more than a projection. But everything else about the room, from the Macassar ebony wood flooring to the Bösendorfer concert grand, to the 1,000-gallon reef aquarium, for Christ's sake, was tangible and virtually identical to the furnishings in his Lake Forest home. If he wasn't running the show and privy to all the company's trade secrets, he would have easily believed his home had been robbed, its contents moved to the 9-story black basalt complex on the shore of Lake Michigan. To his left, against the north wall, lay the fireplace. Owen walked to it, stepping down into a sunken area of the room furnished with a sofa and two oversized chairs. He sat on the hearth and stared into the mouth of the fireplace, presently unlit. The rear and sides were blackened, however, giving the impression that hundreds of fires had been built there. I don't suppose I can light this, Owen said into the helmet's microphone.
No,
Galloway's humorless voice sounded in his ear. Well, we should allow fire, you know what I mean? We should offer that as a weapon.
But we haven't found a way to contain it, control it, while keeping the simulation real.
Yeah, but...
And we need to keep the client safe from harm. We don't want our own Aaron Briggs.
Owen knew what Galloway meant. Everyone did. It was one of the more infamous scandals tied to the industry. Decades before, Aaron Briggs had entered a rage room in Dallas, Texas, with a loaded Glock concealed beneath his body armor, and after repeatedly firing into a holographic image of his father, had turned the handgun on himself. As a result, the Briggs Law had been passed, forbidding anyone to enter a rage room with a weapon other than those approved by the state. Approved weapons included bats, knives, swords, spears, and mallet-like instruments. No more faux murder suicides, or more accurately, faux murder real suicides. If clients wanted to kill themselves on their own time, that was fine, but they couldn't do it on company property. Not surprisingly, only a handful of suicides had been reported post-simulation in the 30-plus years since the Briggs Law had been enacted. Yeah, it makes sense, Owen said. But you have to admit, it'd be fun. It could give us an edge over our competitors. Beat them to the punch, so to speak.
All in due time,
Galloway said.
Besides, we already have that edge.
Then in a surprising turn,
Elijah, Meredith, wouldn't you agree?
There was a short silence before the two scientists voiced their assent. Well, the people have spoken, Owen said, gazing out at the projection of the lake. A few dusky clouds gathered low on the horizon, a harbinger for what was to follow. But listen, I want to offer fire as a weapon if the client requests it, effective immediately. A fireplace caddy stood next to him, complete with poker, trident, spade, and tongs. He drew the trident and examined it closely. It would do fine. Can the reps hear me? He asked.
No,
Galloway replied.
They're in hibernation until you're ready to confront them.
Perfect. He rose and crossed the room, dragging the trident behind him. Three distinct trails followed, gently raking the surface of the ebony flooring. He stopped next to the piano, looking again through the large bay window at the troubled lake beyond. He ran a finger along the keyboard, admiring the craftsmanship. He knew it was only a replica of the $150,000 instrument currently sitting in his home, but damn if it didn't look real. The lid was open, and he peered inside at the guts of the thing. Beautiful. Nan, he said, tightening his grip on the trident. Play me something fitting for this moment. Discordant chimes sounded throughout the room. Valak stood still, listening to the opening of the music. Then, when the brass of Tchaikovsky's finale from the 1812 overture came in, he abandoned all civility, all reason, all self-control. Stepping away from the piano, he swung his weapon at the prop supporting the lid, shattering it instantly, causing the lid to come crashing down. An offensively loud sound violated the room. Before the echo was gone, he brought the trident down again, over and over until the polished lid of the instrument resembled chewed bark. His breathing, along with his heart rate, rose in response. He moved to the end of the fake Bösendorfer and used the trident to bang away at its rear leg. After three or four vicious swings, he began to kick at it instead, the leg buckling under the assault. Finally, when it could take no more, it snapped, and the cabinet collapsed to the floor with a tremendous crash. Satisfied for the moment, he retreated, then ran at the wounded piano, scrambling up its lid until he was perched atop the instrument like a climber having reached the summit of a mountain. From this vantage point, he paused to once more take in the details of the room. Remarkable, he thought. Truly. Hanging on the far wall was a reproduction of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss. The actual masterpiece, much like the Bösendorfer, resided safely in his home. He had paid $180 million for it 9 years ago as a wedding present for his wife, because she'd admired it, and because he loved her. And Europe's banks were failing massively at the time, and, well, Austria needed the cash. He had never really cared for it, which made his next decision that much easier as he sprinted across the room to destroy it. He slashed at it with the trident, the canvas ripping away in strips. Heart rate is 170 and climbing, one of the techs said. He's enjoying himself, Galloway observed. Seeing none of this, Elijah stood in the shadows of the control room, listening to Valak's primal screams and the continuous crashing, tearing, stabbing sounds. He tried to imagine the man's face. He had always pictured him as handsome, charismatic. But now he saw the bones in Valak's face protruding, straining against the skin, threatening to tear through. Owen looked up and panted into his mic. You're positive they're not picking any of this up? Waiting for me to kill them? Galloway repeated.
As I said, they're in hibernation.
Good. Then rhetorically, where to next? He stepped down into the sunken living area in the middle of the room. His breathing slowed as he regarded the white leather sofa. He pictured his wife reclined there, trembling with excitement under her fuckboy paramour. Surely they had done it there, and there, and there. They might have even done it on top of the piano, he mused sickly. He crossed to the sofa, and ever the conqueror stood atop it. Motherfucker, he whispered, plunging the trident repeatedly into the cushions. Stuffing issued forth, bits of it clinging to the iron prongs. Abruptly, he turned and brought the trident down on top of the large square coffee table next to the sofa. Glass exploded into the air. Several splinters of it ricocheted off Owen's face shield. A swing, connecting with a floor lamp. Then back to the sofa, back to the coffee table. The statuary on either side, a pair of 17th-century marble cherubs, were the next to fall. Finally, Valak sat down on the ruined sofa, what remained of it, put his feet up, and after a moment of silence, commanded, "All right, Galloway, turn them on. Whatever it is you do, I'm going in."
"You're sure?"
Galloway said.
"This is your show, Owen. You may take as long as you like."
"Yeah, I'm sure." He stood, dusting off some bits of glass, and took a few steps toward the adjoining bedroom. Its door was shut. He paused, studying it quietly from several feet away. This was the main event. This was what the Purgers paid the big bucks for. Only he was about to get the real deal. Or at least the closest thing to the real deal current technology could provide. Valak quivered with excitement. And then he did something that surprised Galloway and the others watching. He retreated a step or two, looked up to the control room, and said, "Hold on, Philip. Don't wake them up just yet. One more thing." He was still holding the trident, littered with bits of the Klimt in the sofa. He lifted it and ran across the room, wielding the iron fork over his head. "Oh, shit, no," one of the techs whispered.
"What is it?" Elijah asked. "What's he doing?"
"It's the aquarium," Meredith said. With everything in him, Valak swung his weapon at the glass, stepping quickly aside so as not to be carried away by the wall of water. But turning around to inspect the damage, he saw his attack had resulted in only a hairline fissure. "Really?" Owen said. "Really?" He let out a great sigh. "I mean, come on." He swung again at the 2-inch-thick acrylic, and again. "Heart rate is over 200, said the same tech from before. A spiderweb of cracks appeared in the aquarium's wall, but it showed no sign of yielding. Valak hit once more. Nothing. "Fuck it," he said, tossing the trident aside. He stepped down into the sunken area, surveying the mess. At his feet lay a decapitated cherub. He looked about for its marble head. Spying it in the wreckage of the coffee table, he picked it up, tossed it in the air like a softball. "Fuck it," he said again, and viciously threw the angel's head at the aquarium. It punched through the glass like a cannonball tearing through the side of a Spanish galleon. For the briefest of moments, there was a stillness, a suspension of time, and then the entire front of the 1,000-gallon tank gave way. Balak was thrown backward, lifted off his feet, and tossed aside like a rag doll. In a matter of seconds, the tank had emptied its contents into the sunken living area, filling it with a number of brightly colored tropical fish. They darted about their new habitat, the ruins of the furniture bobbing about like so much flotsam. Lying on his back beside the newly created pool occupying the center of the room, Valak groaned. He was disoriented and sore. He stared up at the coffered ceiling above him, fully aware that the men and women in the control room were staring back. "Does this thing still work?" he sputtered into the helmet's microphone.
"Yes, we're reading you,"
came Galloway's voice.
"Would you like to abort the simulation?"
"Would I what?" Owen replied.
"You might be injured."
"What?"
"Injured."
Then,
"I'm aborting. Send in a cleanup team."
"No, you're not, Philip. I'm just getting started. You send anyone in here, you'll find this fireplace fork halfway up your ass." Stifled laughter came from one of the techs in the control room. Philip Galloway, Owen noted, did not deign to respond. "Speaking of which," Valak said, "where is that thing?"
It's next to you in the water,"
another tech offered. "Ah, so it is." Valak removed his helmet and set it aside. His hair was dripping wet, but it was unclear if it was sweat or tank water or both. He waded into the sunken, now quite literally, living area to retrieve his weapon. Several neon tetras swam nervously by, exploring their new habitat. Directly across from him, an angelfish floundered about, helpless amidst the ruins of the Klimt. Valak took pity on the fish and swept it back into the water. It swam away excitedly. As he bent down to pick up the trident, Owen lost his footing, plunging unexpectedly into the cold water. Above, Galloway mumbled, "This is a farce." A moment later, Valak burst out of the water, bearing the trident. He held it aloft, suddenly feeling mythic in appearance. "Meredith, who am I?" he said. A brief silence followed. Valak frowned. In the control room above, several techs exchanged confused looks.
"Where did he go?" Elijah asked.
"He's taken his helmet off. He's saying something, we're just not hearing it," Meredith answered. "Audio, can we get inside the room, please?" Galloway said. A few taps from one of the techs, and instantly, Valak's voice was heard over the intercom system.
"Go ahead, Meredith, take a guess."
We didn't catch what you said," she replied, her voice echoing back from the speakers below. Standing half-submerged and brandishing the trident, Valak repeated,
"Who am I?"
I don't understand."
"This is an easy one. Come on, take a guess."
"Poseidon," Galloway finally muttered. Valak's lip curled.
"The question was for Meredith, Philip. If I'd wanted you to answer, I'd have asked you. Quit showing off."
Galloway shifted uncomfortably. Meredith observed that he might have even shown a bit of humility in that moment, a rare quality, certainly, to be displayed by either man.
"All right, fun's over. Time to kill some people."
Valak stepped out of the pool and moved purposefully in the direction of the adjacent room. Instantly, Galloway was back, all business again. "Animate the replicants," he commanded, his tone measured but strong. As Valak reached the closed bedroom door, he heard moans of pleasure coming from inside. He paused. They were distinctly female and, disturbingly, belonging to his wife. This came as no surprise, but it did cause him to flush with rage. His head felt hot. He thought perhaps he might throw up. Closing his eyes, he took several deep breaths. The moans grew louder, closer together. Owen opened the door. His bedroom, reproduced in every detail. And there, in the middle of it all, his wife, splayed on the bed, fuckboy Paramore on top of her. The sheets had been thrown or kicked off and were lying in a heap on the floor. Jillian, Owen's wife, was tied to the four-poster with bathrobe ties, one from his robe and one from hers. Bastard was wearing my bathrobe, he thought. Nice touch. Hi, Owen said. Jillian screamed and instinctively tried to cover herself, failing pitifully. Fuckboy seemed even more surprised. He rolled quickly off her, assuming a defensive posture on the far side of the bed. He looked ridiculous, holding a pillow over his groin.
Oh, Owen, Jillian stammered. Owen, I,
she said, tugging at her bonds. Then, unexpectedly, what are you wearing? Oh, this, he answered, taking his time. This is just standard issue at the company. For the simulations, I mean.
I don't understand,
she said, still working to loosen her ties. Look, I'm sorry, the male replicant babbled. This is all just... It's okay, Owen said to Fuckboy. Really, it's fine. A brief moment to savor. It's my show now. Jillian whimpered, a combination of fear and utter confusion. He almost felt sorry for her, this woman he had met by chance years ago. 7? At a charity event. She had been wearing a little black vest and tie, serving salmon on toast, and had walked right up to him, saying something in German meant to impress him. She'd been told he spoke a number of languages, including that one. While this was true, Owen did not speak German. The moment had led to an awkward exchange, resulting in unadulterated, silly laughter. And if it were possible for Valak to feel real affection for someone, as so many thought him incapable of, he was certain he had felt it then.
Seriously, I am so sorry. Let me just grab my shit and I'm gone, Fuckboy pleaded, moving toward a pair of pants thrown into the corner of the room.
What's your name? Owen asked.
What?
Your name. A moment. The naked man looked toward Jillian, down at his now flaccid member, and then back at Owen.
It's Kurt.
Kurt what?
Kurt Messman?
That's right, Owen said. He ran his fingers through a wet head of hair. What's your earliest memory? Several blinks of incomprehension.
I don't remember.
Try. Either way, this isn't going to end well for you. On the bed, Jillian had gone almost still. She appeared to be in a state of shock. Owen picked up the comforter lying at his feet and gently covered her naked body.
A meteor shower, the Kurt replicant blurted. I remember watching it with my father. I was 7 years old, 6 or 7.
Owen beamed, his smile growing ever broader as he glanced back at Jillian. Beautiful.
Christ, remarkable.
They, Galloway and his team, had pioneered this. Replicant technology had been around for a number of years, but this eclipsed anything the scientific community had yet achieved. Composite memory encoding, CME for short, a behavioral science that had been studied for the last decade using reps as test subjects. Many had gotten close to unlocking its true potential. But until now, attempts had been nothing more than short forays into uncharted territory, yielding few results. Until now. Catharsis had cracked it. It worked. And the beauty of it was that he now owned the technology, could use it as leverage in this continually expanding industry. The race to understand and implement CME had been outlined in a journal article published roughly 1 year ago. The contributing author had been none other than Philip Arthur Galloway, chief bioengineer at Catharsis Incorporated. In the article, Galloway had stated, "In its earliest stages, the rage room industry was essentially a cottage industry. Those who had the means set up crude, destructible environments and then charged their customers rather obscene prices to destroy them, allowing for minimal purgation and maximum profit.
Later, as holographic technology evolved, it made sense to add human holograms to the simulations. After all, the client's rage was rarely ever directed toward, say, a piece of furniture. That was simply the appetizer, if you will. What they were far more interested in was destroying, killing, the person they felt had wronged them. This period lasted for quite a while, and during this time, a number of startup companies rode in on the coattails of their predecessors. It was also during this time that the rage room industry became the fastest-growing business worldwide. This left scientists, such as myself, in a quandary. We were, after all, scientists, not businessmen. Yet, here we were in the middle of a business, and the mandate being issued was clearly, we want replicants in there. They are the true objects of our client's wrath. And so the first phase of that came to pass. The holographic reps delivered. They displayed emotion, reacted appropriately under a given set of circumstances. They showed fear. But it was programmed fear. It wasn't authentic. And the clients knew it. They were dissatisfied with the experience, most of them. They wanted to be able to elicit terror in their victims, see it in their eyes. And that was when CME came along. And frankly, it was a game changer. Suddenly, that fear was acute. It was real in a way that we had never seen, because with memory came context. When people are able to grasp exactly what they stand to lose, and that this particular loss happens to be their life, well, it changes the stakes. Owen felt a man's belt tightening around his throat, pulling him forcibly back into the moment. It caught him completely by surprise, and for a split second he felt disconnected, as though he was perhaps dying in slow motion. It was painful, but for some reason his body failed to react. Then a moment of clarity. He was being choked to death by the Kurt thing. One hand instinctively reached up, attempting to slip fingers between the belt and his neck. He felt himself being lifted off the floor. The naked man, intent on killing him, was unusually strong. Above, several techs shot panicked looks toward Philip Galloway. He responded calmly with a simple, "Wait." Owen and the Kurt thing began to do a kind of interpretive dance, spinning about the room as Jillian's eyes grew wider, a pitiful, helpless expression on her face. They knocked things over, crashing into a mirror, a valet. Consciousness waned as Owen's oxygen was depleted. The room became fuzzy and half-lit. As the world grew dark, it occurred to him he was still holding the trident in his right hand. With what little strength he had remaining, he brought it down behind him, felt the iron prongs pierce long ways through the Kurt thing's naked foot. It screamed a sharp, animalistic scream and immediately released him. Balak crumpled to the floor, sucking air into his lungs. Next to him, the Kurt thing continued to scream, then abruptly stopped when it looked down at its foot. The trident had effectively cleaved the appendage in two, starting between the second and third toes, slicing back to the ankle. It ran, tried to run. Dragging its ruined foot, a bloody tangle of muscle and tendon, it limped out of the bedroom and into the living room. There, it promptly slipped on the wet flooring and fell with a heavy thud. Rolling over, it began to crawl in the direction of the fireplace. Naked, through a field of shattered glass, it pulled itself steadily across the room, leaving blood in its wake.
"What's it doing?" Meredith whispered.
"I'm not sure," Galloway replied. Meredith noticed that even he seemed utterly transfixed by the events happening beneath them. All of the techs were watching. Some had abandoned their stations, standing to get a better view. Reaching the fireplace, the male replicant pulled itself up. Several small shards of glass were embedded in its stomach, forearms, and legs, but the thing seemed oddly unconcerned. It seized the poker from the fireplace caddy and turned around. But Valak was already there, no less than 3 feet away. Before the thing could act, he drove the trident through its shoulder, cracking the scapula and causing it to howl once more in pain. Possessed by a fury that had overtaken him, Valak swung the Kurt thing violently around in an arc as though he were pitching hay. It flew off the prongs of the trident and fell backward into the reservoir of water in the middle of the room. Instantly, Valak was upon it, driving the fork through its shoulder in the same spot, pinning it underwater. Its eyes were wide with fear as it struggled to free itself and come up for air. It's frightened, Owen thought. It knows it's about to die. Good. It wrenched its body away from the trident with terrific force, and the few ropes of muscle that hadn't torn could hold no longer. The arm came away, leaving a cavity filled with blood and gore. A curious betta, turquoise in color, moved in at once to investigate, nibbling at the sinew. The curt thing went still, eyes and mouth agape. Owen stared back at it, refused to allow himself to feel anything other than complete satisfaction. Galloway had done it. This was incredible. Revolutionary. Want to kill your wife? Don't waste your time with a hologram. Come to Catharsis and experience firsthand our latest cloning technology, utilizing composite memory encoding. Owen. He looked up. Jillian stood by the side of the pool, wrapped in a white bedsheet clutched tightly at the neck. She surveyed the room, the Bösendorfer, the Klimt, the exploded shell of the aquarium. Owen, she said again. What have you done? Her eyes were red, her cheeks streaked with mascara. In spite of that, Owen thought she looked beautiful as ever. Angelic.
Vernichtung, Jillian. Vernichtung.
And smiling, he waded slowly toward her through the bloodied water.